I love the smell of ding dong in the morning.
My God, that's how you're starting this?
I've been waiting so long to be able to genuinely say that line on this show.
Dear Lord, we are off to a start.
What better time than when we're doing an episode on Apocalypse Now? Welcome to Ding Dong Darkness Time. I'm Allison Dixon, and I'm joined today by one of my favorite guys. He's been here before. He'll be here again. He is Legion. He is also a host of the fantastic horror movie podcast, Press Play and Scream, which you should press pause right now and go follow. I'm talking, of course, about Josh Bremont. Welcome to the show, my guy. Welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you very, very much. It's wonderful to be back, as always, and to discuss movies with you. Absolutely.
You first joined us back in... or joined me, rather, back in, God, episode 5, when we did the Twilight Zone movie incident, the infamous helicopter incident. And I figured, really from that point on, I was like, all right, I know, like, that went so well. I'm like, let's do another movie that is about Vietnam and has a really messed up production story, although not like decapitating a lead actor and two innocent kids with a helicopter messed up, but...
No, but pretty messed up in its own way. I mean, you say weird onset story, like Twilight Zone had one, but Apocalypse Now had about 750. They just were not even quite lethal, but could have been very easily.
Very much so. I'm honestly surprised as I both watch this movie again and then watch the documentary Hearts of Darkness that Francis Ford Coppola's wife actually made back in 1991. Fantastic documentary, by the way. I could only find it for rent on Apple TV, but it could just be out there. It might even be on YouTube. For all I know, it's that old.
Could be.
But very well worth watching and get a great behind-the-scenes look at this movie. We're almost going to talk more about the behind-the-scenes aspects of this movie, but we're going to kind of dovetail a little back and forth because what's happening on the screen is so riveting and so atmospheric and such a masterpiece in so many ways. And it's so hard to believe as you're watching it that what was going on during the making of it, it was such a chaotic clusterfuck in so many ways. It's almost like, have you ever, you watched the documentary about the making of Star Wars, you know, that really long one that came with like the DVD. It's like 3-hour long documentary about Star Wars, the like the making of it.
If it came with the, are you talking about the re-release DVDs from like the late 90s? I probably had those and watched them, but I wouldn't have, I've seen probably 4 or 5 documentaries about Star Wars and the making of it since then. They've got a great one on Disney Plus for anyone who wants to.
And it might be, I mean, there have been a few really good documentaries, but anybody who's looked at the making of that movie and then you watch Star Wars and you're like, I can't believe this, they pulled this off at all, let alone whatever, just all the obstacles they were running into while making it, that the perseverance alone is just something to really remark upon. And interestingly enough, I mentioned Star Wars because who was actually meant to make this film originally, Josh, other than Orson Welles? But that was an adaptation of The Heart of Darkness. But we'll get to that. But who was originally going to make Apocalypse Now? George Lucas was
that
originally.
That would have been bizarre. That would have been bizarre. It's hard to think of anyone but Coppola making a film like this. Now, and it's funny that you would say that, you know, when you look at the movie itself, you wouldn't think that all of this was happening behind the scenes. Like, I absolutely would, because on the rewatch, this is not a vision put forth by a man who was on any kind of steady ground, physically or mentally or emotionally. His own just feelings of being crazed and lost and hopeless and nothing making any kind of sense and being in complete danger all the time comes across, I think, in every square inch of this film. Like, this is you know, this is why I love this movie better than any other Vietnam War movie, and pretty much better than any other war movie in general, is because it's also, I mean, it's not really, when you come right down to it, about the Vietnam War at all. It's this phantasmagoric, and we'll get to so much of this later on, but this surreal landscape is being presented to us that is not like other movies show you the gritty, bloody, face down in the mud, guts spilling out, like, and this is all of that too. But this lifts it, I feel, into something that is almost abstract filmmaking in terms of how it's presented with the mist and the colors and the lights and the darkness and the, you know, I mean, this is not just Vietnam. This right. is in many ways a version of hell. But again, there's one thing that I wanted to kind of touch on, though, before we even get into any of that, which is that it's really hard to not first at least acknowledge the source material for something yes. like that. Because, of course, you've got Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness.
Absolutely.
And it's 1899. And for its time, a very harsh critique of British colonialism as it was happening.
Mm-hmm.
And now here we have an also harsh for its time critique of American imperialism.
Yes.
As we're still dealing with the immediate fallout from Vietnam, which was the complete American nightmare of losing a war, which we hadn't done, giving an entire generation of veterans just a head full of broken glass. In 79, when this came out, we hadn't even begun
mm-hmm.
to process what the fuck we had just gone through. And the entire, again, just bizarre window between Kennedy and Nixon. Yeah. Just one of the weirdest blocks of American history.
I can't even imagine it. When you read about that time, I mean, you're talking about like presidents being assassinated, civil rights leaders being assassinated, and
Watergate.
You know, and then the counterculture movement happening, the free love movement, and all this stuff getting, and then you get into the 70s, a president resigns, and uh-huh. and it's just, you know, we talk about our own tumultuous times. But we sometimes talk about them like they were brand new to the country. The more I think about it, you know, when we talk about the peaceful times, that's never been a thing, really. I feel like our history as a country has always been awash in blood in some way.
Yeah.
Almost from one bloody thing to the next. We've never really had a moment to truly enjoy the fruits of our labors, whatever you want to call them. Without running into the next catastrophe or the next, you know, crisis of some kind. So
the 90s were about as close a block of time as we got to something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And even then you got like, you know, Ruby Ridge and Waco and you
yeah.
know, all this and then, you know, all the other manufactured crap. But, you know, it's interesting to think about. But Vietnam, it was such a touchy subject at the time that they were looking to make this film originally. It was around the kind of the early to mid 70s. And it was actually George Lucas and the screenwriter, and Melius, I think his name is. They all got together to try to come up with an adaptation of The Heart of Darkness after a lot of attempts were made by Orson Welles originally was going to try to adapt this film. And as they were getting into pre-production and everything, they were running into all kinds of obstacles with sets and locations and money and, you know, studios couldn't agree, yada, yada. So Welles shelves it and goes and makes Citizen Kane. I guess there had been a few other attempts over time to adapt it. In fact, the story became almost infamous. They were saying it's the impossible dream. We're never going to be able to adapt this story. It's always just been there. It's got this really compelling narrative. Amazing. You could just see it so clearly in your mind, this riverboat journey through this foreboding jungle into the unknown. And for some reason, they just couldn't make it happen. And then when they sat down to actually write this, Francis Ford Coppola wasn't even involved yet. It was Lucas and the screenwriter who originally actually wanted to volunteer for Vietnam, but he didn't qualify because he was not physically fit and he had asthma. And so they, again, shelved it. And then George Lucas actually wanted to be a dark comedy. and he had a whole different vision. It's sort of like whenever you hear about Lucas's early vision for Star Wars, to bring that up again, completely different. It had lizard people and, as you know, and all this stuff. It was a way different story than what we end up seeing because other people had input. Well, you know, they couldn't get it made. So then, and Lucas was also involved in making THX and American Graffiti and all that. Well, then he goes on and makes Star Wars. And then Francis Ford Coppola comes along and he takes a look at the script and he's like, kind of like this, you know? And so then they start getting to work around 1976 or so. They start casting it, start putting all the things together. They went through a lot of different actors. It's really interesting to see all the people who were meant to be originally wanted to be in this movie, like Jack Nicholson, Robert Redford, and James Caan were approached to play Colonel Kurtz, who Marlon Brando ends up playing.
None of those would have made any sense at all. I thought you were going to say that they were considered for Willard, which would have made a lot more sense for any of them. Like, I could see James Caan playing Captain Willard.
Yeah, and I think they did say that a couple of them were also considered for Willard. Keith Carradine and Nick Nolte were also considered for Willard.
Nolte would have been good, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Which is interesting, too. In a Hollywood Reporter interview, apparently Clint Eastwood revealed that Coppola had offered him Willard. But none of these guys wanted to leave the country for that long, because that's the thing. You can't make this movie here in the United States. There's really nowhere comparable you can film it. We just don't have that kind of ecology here in this country.
Yeah.
And of course, at the time in the 70s, we're still dealing with the fallout of Vietnam. George Lucas actually wanted to film the movie over in South Vietnam right during while the war was wrapping up. And there were like studios were like, hell no, we're not going to do that. And also, they didn't want to make a Vietnam movie in the first place. We're talking 1976. The war wrapped up in 1974, right?
Yeah.
So who is going to make a movie that soon, especially like you said, one that we lost? How do we go and make that movie?
Yeah.
Not in a way I would say that would be truthful. The Vietnam War movies that came out later, Deer Hunter, Coming Home, I believe that was a Vietnam film. And then we have, of course, Platoon and Born on the 4th of July. You know, the 80s had a lot of, you know, Vietnam movies. So this was daring to come up with this at this time to sort of build Conrad's Heart of Darkness with a Vietnam theme to it. It was very loosely adapted, though. For the most part, it even used the same names. In Conrad's book, wasn't it, Kurtz was a trader.
An
ivory trader, that's right. And he was lost and kind of lost his mind, taken up with the natives. And so the other traders are going up the river to try to, find him and get him.
And that's set in Africa, of course, as opposed
to the Congo, right? Yeah.
Yes.
In this one, they're in Vietnam, and Captain Willard is, they don't really go out of their way to explain how he got involved in this kind of thing, but Willard, played by Martin Sheen, he's brought in on a mission because he's done missions like this before, where they're off book, you go take someone out, and this never happened. We never had this conversation. He's worked for the CIA, right?
Yeah, and if I can just point out, by the way, about that scene, because in a movie full of amazing, amazing scenes,
yeah,
this is one that even stands a little bit above the rest, because, at least for me, because first of all, you've got, again, speaking of Star Wars, Harrison Ford.
Yes.
One of the young pencil pushers, bespectacled, who's, kind of going over these things with him. And he's the one who's asking Willard, played by Martin Sheen, of course, about, his previous, what we would call Black Ops missions. And yeah, Martin Sheen is standing there. And I love the way that he is able to make every denial with his performance completely confirm that he has done all of these things that they're asking about and a lot more. Like, everyone in this room is sweating, but Willard is sweating.
Right.
And it's neat to note, by the way, that this scene also became a very direct reference in a popular X-Files episode, Musings of the Cigarette Smoking Man.
I didn't know that.
We see this whole thing played out with a young smoking man, where they're asking him, did you participate in the assassination of Patrice Lumumba? No, sir, I have no memory of that whatsoever, nor have I ever been involved in any. And a look in his eyes, of course he has.
Look in his eyes.
But also with Willard, during that scene, he's kind of jittery. He can't make eye contact. He's playing it like a lot of adrenaline junkies, like how John Bernthal played Frank Castle. He's just a PTSD head case. He's fidgeting when there's no action and there's no killing. These guys, and he does such a perfect job of it, they're like sharks. If they don't keep moving forward, always forward, if they pause long enough to process any of the things that they've seen or done, they sink like a stone immediately.
I love how you use that as a metaphor, because when the movie opens, right, it opens on one of the most infamous stories of the making of this movie. which, you know, it's a very iconic thing. First, you open on this thick, dense shot of jungle, impenetrable.
And you open, by the way, with the door.
The doors, yeah.
I mean, that is a punch in the mouth. Hey, pay attention. You're about to see something really important.
There are so many times when I've watched, gosh, especially a lot of older films, sometimes, you know, the pacing of an older movie is something you have to adjust to, that you have to be ready for, right? It's usually a little more drawn out. It takes a little long to get into it sometimes. So a modern attention span sometimes runs up against that challenge of when you start, say, watching movies pre-2000s, to be completely honest. But so we're talking about a movie from 1979 here, grabs you from the get-go. And this is what I also love. It wastes no time giving you the mission. We start with Martin Sheen and alone in a bedroom.
Yeah.
Who's having a bit of a breakdown, right? He's
oh, more than a bit. Yeah.
He's drinking. He's kind of probably
doing Tai Chi.
Yeah. Doing Tai Chi in his underwear.
Yeah. He's crying and he's punching the mirror and blood comes out of his hand and he's like, you know, on the floor naked and he's again, just collapsed and he's sobbing. And
yes.
I mean, do you want to tell the story or should I?
Oh, you go ahead. You go ahead.
Because, like, you know, what a lot of people might not realize about that scene, which, again, is just such a compelling and raw scene. It just grabs you so much, and it's a brilliant performance. But then you find out that it is not a performance, that actually that was Martin Sheen's birthday. He had a lot of mental problems. He, you know, was dealing with addictions and demons, and he fell apart. Those were all things that he was actually doing. And when he punched the mirror and he broke it and he bled, that's not corn syrup. That's his blood.
He really caught himself.
Really, actually. And Coppola filmed it. He filmed the whole thing, just kept the camera on him and rolling. And you can call it extremely irresponsible filmmaking, and you can actually probably call it extremely cruel. But I can't sit here and pretend that it's not completely, completely compelling and a shocking scene in a movie that's full of them.
You almost know in the subconscious sense watching this that what you're seeing is real. Like you've been, if you've ever had a moment in your life at the lowest part of your life, you can look at this, you can see yourself in it, you know, and it's raw. Like you said, very, very raw. And you make an excellent point because Coppola had a way of working with actors where, you know, he would set the scene, he would give them some dialogue, he would give them the script or whatever, but he would, in the Hearts of Darkness documentary, just watching him interact with the actors, he'd say, you know, you have to learn the lines so you can forget the lines.
Well, one actor specifically,
Dennis Hopper.
Referred to the gills and probably on a bunch of other stuff and couldn't remember his lines to begin with, and was just basically supposed to be playing a character who's a complete nutcase, but was in a time of his life where he was actually a complete nutcase.
Absolutely. And he was lucky to even have the job. He said himself, he's like, I didn't expect to ever get a job.
And yet, as I'm sure we'll talk about later, when again, one of the most brilliant performances in a movie with no bad performances.
Oh, yeah. God. Yeah, it's hard to really pick a favorite, right? They're all the big ones all really stand out.
Oh, and by the way, as far as knowing, like, instinctively, as you were saying, and you're very right about that, that when you're watching that scene, even if you aren't aware of the story, there's some quiver in your gut that's telling you that what you're watching is not fabricated. And you also have to remember that this is the same movie where we see a real, actual, live, not fake, water buffalo get hacked to pieces on screen in a extremely gory fashion. Not, again, not fake either. And you get the same feeling right there in the pit of your stomach. There's nothing like real. It's grotesque. Sometimes it's reckless in terms of filmmaking. But again, you know, I mean, I don't advocate it for it, but
we could say it was a different time. I think, honestly, there were so everybody on the set of this movie was either in the grips of a substance or a maniacal drive to finish. I don't know if Coppola was a drug user. Honestly, I don't know. I know he drank or drinks. He's not dead. I'm talking about him in the past tense because I haven't seen a Coppola film. I don't think he's made anything in a long time. So when I talk about him in the past tense, I only mean in the tense of his work. But they were all, you know, the guy who was a Sam Bottoms who played the surfer. He talked about how screwed, messed up he was. They were all stoned or on acid or.
And it comes across.
Yeah.
It comes across. Again, there's something about this movie that even though it is far more surreal and far more over the top than even the real Vietnam would have been until you're transported into a dark and terrible nightmare and fairy tale kind of place.
Right.
It's the biggest lie that tells the biggest truth. As exaggerated as this is, it communicates what's really this is about, which is, again, the horror and the surreality and topsy-turvydom of being in a place like that at that time.
It's weird how it does that and never overtly. It doesn't feel like a in and of it, you know what I mean? Like an anti-war movie. You can tell, you can feel the movie screaming at you. War is bad, but the movie doesn't really do that. It takes you into this sort of miasma of, like you said, hell. It doesn't need to tell you. It shows you, and it shows it in a way that is so, it doesn't tell you with the dialogue. It doesn't tell you with a whole lot. It's just the overall feeling. So it doesn't feel like it's like a message movie, but you feel the message. You feel what it's trying to say. And so it just comes off very organically. And again, I think that really does come from Coppola's method of immersing all these people in this environment and giving them this story that has to be told. And then, of course, it's compounded by all the challenges that they face while making it. My God, I mean...
Yeah.
There are so many. It's one of those things that, you know, as I was compiling my notes for this, the biggest problem I had was trying to make sure, oh, I don't want to forget something, because I can't think of very many movies that have this much trivia crammed into them, you know, in terms of the story itself and the backstory is really something.
Yeah. And in terms of, I think you're absolutely right. This is not, this is distant from the aforementioned films you were talking about, the war movies of the 80s, that, you know, isn't war hell? And, you know,
yeah.
This is about something far more primal. And it's boiled down, and there's so much to unpack about it later, but it's boiled down by Kurtz's monologue at the end. And he keeps using the words judgment and judgmental. You cannot judge. You cannot be judgmental. Any more than you could judge a hurricane.
Yes.
Judge a virus, or you can judge an earthquake. It's not war is bad. It's that war is.
War is.
Period.
And that, I'll get to that point here in a second too, because I feel like the way he illustrates that point, I'm going to pluck a moment from this one. It's a very well-known scene when we meet Robert Duvall, who plays Kilgore. He's a ranger or a cavalryman.
Yeah.
And so after Willard takes this mission, he has his crew, and they need Kilgore to help them deliver their boat essentially to the correct river that they need to go to in order to ride up where they think Kurtz is. So because Willard is under very, very direct orders to kill Colonel Kurtz. Colonel Kurtz is...
What's the actual phrase now?
With extreme prejudice.
Terminate with extreme prejudice. Yes. One of the coldest lines in movie history.
That guy, I don't even... The guy who delivered that line, I do not want to sit across from that guy. Yeah. He's one of those guys that just... That you always want to ask, like, if you're just a character actor that looks and behaves a certain way, like, what does it feel like to always just be cast as the creepy, scumbaggy looking, you know, government guy? Because... Yeah. I could just see him doing that. But yeah, after he takes that order, they assemble their team that includes, I already mentioned, I didn't mention Lawrence Fishburne.
17 we gotta talk about that first.
Exactly. Year old. He's a baby.
He's amazing. Actually 14 in this flick, playing 17.
Oh my God.
And I love that. I love that. It says so much about war in general, and this war in particular. There's always plenty of children who managed to find their way into, even if they're underage, like my father, you know, he was in World War II, and he was in Target when he was 18.
Yeah.
I remember being 13 years old, finding his old military dress uniform in the closet, trying it on. It was too tight for me at 13.
Oh, man.
This man was built like a 9-year-old and he was sent off to fight Nazis. Like, you know, it's always some skinny, scrawny Steve Rogers before the treatment looking dude. You know?
Yes, yes. That's a very good point. I love that. And I also love, too, as we're going along this movie, we have great voiceover narration by Martin Sheen. It's almost like a noir type voiceover. But it's like, you know, in the context of Vietnam, in the context of war, and it just pulls you right in the way he delivers that. And I want to ask you a question, because a lot of people criticize the voiceover of Blade Runner, their theatrical cut, yeah. Because it overexplains it. You know, we don't need it. I'm neutral on that. I've seen every version of Blade Runner. I love them all for various reasons. But do you feel like this movie would work without the voiceover, or do you feel like it was a necessity to have that?
Absolutely wouldn't work. And I'll tell you something. I'm usually staunchly anti-voiceover. I'm 9 times out of 10. I feel like if you're relying on voiceover, you are absolutely being lazy. Show, don't tell.
Right.
Find an interesting way to get that across. But there are certain movies, and this is one of them, if you do not have that voiceover, you are missing out on a whole other dynamic. You've got, like, Fight Club is a perfect example.
Yes.
You don't have a movie without voiceover. American Psycho, there's no movie without the voiceover there. In this, and you compared it to a noir, and it's funny that you should, because the thing about it is the gruesome and savage poetry of what has been written here, of everything that is dark and sick and twisted and mean, presented in a way that's not just cerebral but visceral and moving at the same time. And you get that from the old Raymond Chandler to a certain degree, but this ramps it up in you know. And earlier we had mentioned the screenwriter John Milius.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the stuff that he's written, I mean, he was a big, rough, dark, savage man.
Yes.
With, as the photojournalist describes of Kurtz, a warrior poet's soul.
Yes.
And so I think that you would lose a lot of that. And
oh, you needed that. You're right, because this is how we get to know Kurtz. As they're traveling upriver, Willard is studying Kurtz's file, right? Because Kurtz was a king badass of the military. You know, he had all the decorations. He was being groomed, as they say, for a spot in the Joint Chiefs. He was,
absolutely,
you know, talked about all these accomplishments that he had doing airborne, joining the airborne at like 38 years of age, which is unheard of. You know, all these amazing things that build up his myth. And I think without that, you don't have that encroaching dread as they are getting closer and closer to their final destination of facing him.
And part of that, too, I'm glad that you brought that up, because we have a movie here, because we did the redo, both of us, as far as I can.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So, which is my favorite.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about this and we'll go into it later. But we have a movie here that's 3 hours and 15 minutes long.
Right.
I clocked it. Kurtz is in fewer than 30 minutes.
Whew.
So yeah. He does not show up until the 2 hour and 37 minute mark, to be really precise about it.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Taking
end credits into effect. He's in it for really a small fraction, but the introduction of Kurtz, as you said, he's an idea.
Mm-hmm.
But even if he is not on screen, he is present in some way throughout this entire movie. He haunts it. And we have, by the way, in that scene where Willard's being given the mission, we have another, because also, obviously, Robert Duvall had worked with Coppola before. We have another Coppola alum, actor G.D. Spradlin,
mm-hmm.
Who played the corrupt Senator Geary of Nevada in The Godfather Part Two, and he's great. He's got that terrific, silky kind of politician's twang.
Oh.
He's that folksy, but somehow dangerous thing about
him. Oh, my God. I almost want you to run for office now.
I know.
I'm ready to vote.
Worse than what we got. And so we've got this guy with that furrow in his brow, and he's saying he's out there operating without any decent restraint,
mm-hmm.
totally beyond the pale of any acceptable human conduct. And Kurtz is described as having ascended to this kind of primitive godhead out there in the jungle, an idol worshipped by the platoon, and they say any order, no matter how frivolous or ridiculous, is carried out under pain of death. And then they play that spine-chilling recording, and it's
terrifying.
I watched a snail crawl along the edge I'm a straight razor. That's my dream. My nightmare. And it's like, you know, we're going to talk about Dracula in a later episode, but this is a fucking boogeyman. You want to talk about Dracula? This is so much scarier because even as surreal as it is, we can believe it. And it's sick and it's horrifying. And we can already get a sense. Not even we think we can get a sense of what we're going to see when we finally see him. And when we do, my God, it's far worse.
It is.
As Americans in 1979, Kurtz as a concept is the thing under our beds. Mm-hmm. He is, you know, our military endeavors run so far amok that they can't even be called military endeavors anymore. And that, by the way, also ties into Robert Duvall's scenes, which, I mean, that's one of the more memorable films because, of course, you know, and one of his more compelling roles, just a totally charming psychopath is like, yep, our job today is to napalm the fuck out of a whole lot of villages, but enough about that. That's a drag. Let's dish about surfing.
Yeah, and there's nobody in this movie who loves his job more than Kilgore loves his fucking job.
He's to be the only one enjoying himself.
The only one. His posture, his stance, his... And then what I meant to mention when I was starting to mention this before and I got sidetracked by my own thoughts is the very famous scene when they're flying in and they're playing Wagner, the Flight of the Valkyries. They're like they're flying in. And I think it's so fucking ironic. And I think and I'm positive this was a choice to use this song because who the fuck is Wagner? He was like the favorite of the Nazis, you know? And so here we are playing this fucking song while we're dropping bombs and napalm on villages.
And it's worth mentioning that this is not just any Robert Duvall. This is this tall, strapping, barrel-chested Robert Duvall with blonde hair. No, that's very intentional.
Oh, yeah. Oh, you're right about the blonde hair.
Yeah.
That's absolutely right. He normally has his hat on, but I remember seeing that bit of blonde underneath.
Yeah, but what you were talking about, of course, of sort of like, you know, things run amok. And he... is one of the earliest examples of that we actually see because, and this goes back to the voiceover as well. When Air Cav is introduced, Willard is doing his voiceover and he says of them, they were terrassing around Vietnam looking for the shit. Mm-hmm. Not they were given orders and they followed those orders.
Right.
Just making up their missions as they go along, killing and napalming and surfing wherever the hell they feel like it, having their fears and their stakes, you know.
So many of these people had no idea what they were supposed to do. They're like, we enter a scene much later on. This is in the redo version. It might not be in the theatrical cut where they arrive further upriver much later in the film. And that's the completely abandoned outpost, essentially. And it's rainy. There'd been a monsoon because there was a real monsoon happening at this time. And we'll get to that in a minute because that created a lot of problems for the production. And they asked, like, where's your CO? Oh, we stepped on a landmine about some couple months ago. Okay. So, and then they have like a water buffalo standing right in the middle of this, and he's been labeled like a fucking ration that's been dropped because they painted graffiti on these water buffalo. It's
a couple of guys playing grab ass, clearly stoned out of them, one of them naked.
Yes.
And this is a scene, yeah, you're right, that was not necessarily included. There are so many of them in the theatrical version.
About 45 minutes were added, I believe.
Yeah,
to the redo.
With this weird little gray, muddy, hopeless, rainy, shitty outpost, no one cares anymore about anything. The aggressive apathy permeated the place. Everyone's stoned to the gills. Whole thing's broken down. It's senseless. There's no good reason for any of them to be there. They all know that. They're kind of giddy from it at this point, like in a state of mild shock and hysteria. Nothing matters.
Yeah.
So in some ways, like, and I wanted to mention, and we'll be going back and forth, obviously, but like this is after the USO show scene.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
If you look at it a certain way, obviously this is Joseph Conrad to some degree, but that you could also read it as the USO show is the Sirens. Mm-hmm. This is the Locust Eaters, like, you know,
the Odyssey.
So very much the Odyssey. Mm-hmm. And this is why, and we were discussing this last night, I do actually prefer the redo because, yes, it is too long. It feels like a tortured slog. You're fucking zapped out, exhausted by the end of it. It is just too much to take in all in one experience. It's a kind of a cinematic endurance test.
Yes.
And it is an odyssey. And that's the way we share in this experience with the characters. And, you know, we get uncomfortably handcuffed. Coppola is not giving us the comfort
None.
Of feeling like we can escape from this experience. Like, oh, this movie's going to be over soon. Any more than people in Vietnam could say that. Like, if I were forced to watch the redo in the theater, I'd probably come away from it feeling fatigued and jittery and sick. And that's good. And I was going to say this isn't some movie about puppies and bunnies, but on the other hand, kind of is. Yeah. Movies, it's important to remember, didn't always need to be comfortable.
Right.
Sometimes great cinema was supposed to be about using extreme art to punish the audience on purpose in a way to make a point. And you can have a great movie, a movie that's brilliant, and it'll haunt you forever. And it could also be something you didn't necessarily, quote, have fun watching. Like,
oh, 12 Years a Slave.
Yeah. Like, we don't really have that now, mostly. Like, filmmakers and studios coddle audiences because they're all shitting peach pits about whether they're going to make their profits this year. Ari Aster, I think, might be one of the only modern exceptions to that, because I haven't seen Bo is Afraid yet.
I cannot wait.
All the reviews would seem to indicate that this is the kind of movie I'm talking about, where it's not necessarily meant to be liked, but it is meant to be experienced, you know, and this is definitely that film. So yeah, even though, yeah, it's too long, but I love that it's too long.
I'm with you completely. When you mentioned like, it should feel like a slog, that, and when you understand the themes of this movie and what it's trying to tell you, it makes it feel like a, almost like a more immersive experience. Like you get to be trapped in this hell like they were and get a little bit of that, but at least you know it has an end point at some point where those guys, you know, the characters as they exist or the people that actually fought over there, they didn't get that luxury. And the people that lived there, the villagers and all that shit, they didn't get that. And so the part that I will say, the redo felt, where it stretched out a bit too far for me, was the rubber plantation with the French family. However,
that's one of my favorite scenes.
However, yeah, I went on rethought. I have to say, I'm really glad they kept that in there. For those who don't know, really quick flash history lesson. Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos were all part of French Indochina. It was a colony. That's why we were fighting in Vietnam in the first place. You know, we're not a fan of colonialism, but France is our friend. France is losing control of that area due to communist uprising. But we're also heavily anti-communist. So we as Americans are like, I guess we got to help our colonist friends. And so we go over there, but then France bails and we're fucking stuck in this quagmire. That's the flash history lesson. However, there were French families and part of the colonies and workers and, you know, estates that were still over there in Vietnam while all this was going on. So Francis wanted to capture that aspect of the sort of 1950s French glory days of yes. Vietnam. And so they arrive after many battles and a whole lot of bullshit. They've already lost a few people by this point of their team. But they arrive at the rubber plantation, and it's almost like something out of a fucking storybook, right? I mean, it's such a break in the madness. It's all, and I think that's the one opportunity that Coppola gives us to possibly breathe a little bit, but then you just get a sense of so much else that's going on.
Yeah, it seems like a respite. Then you walk in and you take a few deep breaths and you think, wait a minute, Is the ground sinking? Is all of this sinking into quicksand? You have stepped into from fear into dread, which is yes. a different. We forget about the French involvement in all this, but yeah, we have this bizarre pocket of declining colonial civilization, and they are clinging fiercely,
very much
white knuckled and staunchly in denial of the plain fact that their way of life is not going to last more than a few more minutes. And they're basically the aristocrats who are standing on the deck of the Titanic, insisting that this whole sinking thing, don't worry, it's only temporary and we'll have the boat back in no time. This morosely austere slice of late 19th century France in the middle of the jungle and explosions and tigers and death. And right before this, we had a slice of the American ghetto with the Black Platoon. And before that, we had a slice of the kind of crass and glitzy American showbiz with the bunny scene. We have strange cuttings of America growing crooked from the hideous garden of Vietnam.
Oh, yes.
And the impassioned speech, because again, they think they can relax for a minute and they enjoy a beautiful, beautiful feast. And we get this, things decline in terms of the tone of the conversation, because we have this impassioned speech from their French host, Hubert. And it's not only a portrait of colonial power struggling with its own decline and stubbornly insisting they've lost too many times already, they're not going to give any more ground, they're making their stand here, and we as viewers know exactly what their future is. But more than that, this is also the ghost of Christmas future visiting us. For the people in the audience, again, the Vietnam War had been over for about 4 years, and we lost. The big, unstoppable superpower, the One World War II, just got pantsed viciously by a bunch of farmers dwelling in huts. And it's the first, it's hard not to, as a nation, even if we're holding it down and not acknowledging it, that's the first domino, and we just heard it fall. And everything you bear is saying about what's going on back in France, the young people are protesting, the politicians don't care, armaments they're getting sent don't work. It's being spoken with a French accent, but he's describing every condition in America during the same time. And another Frenchman there insists, well, why don't you just win? You have a big American army, you can win. Why don't you? Well, we were asking ourselves that very same question at the moment, because we were still stuck in the World War II mentality of warfare, of whoever has the most troops and the biggest tanks and the shiniest helmet is going to win. Vietnam retaught us a lesson that we should have remembered from the Revolutionary War, which is it doesn't work like that. If a people are fighting for their freedom and they're using guerrilla tactics against an oppressor, they'll wear them down and they're going to win.
And it happened again in Iraq. I mean, for being perfectly honest, this is the way wars are fought now. World War II was basically the end of traditional rules of engagement as
Korea,
we
to some degree, ever.
Yeah, exactly. You're absolutely right. And from that point on, it really did become, I don't know if I'm using the phrase war of attrition correctly here, but it really is about whoever holds out the longest at this point. We just did not hold out the longest. We look at Afghanistan, very similar thing too. We get involved in these wars and now we're doing all these proxy wars because we can't quite muster what it took. Again, it took a combination of shared sacrifice and unity to rise up against and fight the Nazis. And we just, that took everything we had. And then we just kind of didn't have anything left. And then the Korean War happened. And then the Cold War kicks in. And then half the world starts shutting each other out. And now we have to go and fight this war in a jungle on the other side of the world for a cause that doesn't make a whole lot of sense to most people. You know, I mean, at least with the Nazis and with Japan, they attacked us. So at least it had a clear purpose, a stated mission, whether you believed it or not, that's not the point, but you could never say that the aims behind World War II were vague. They were so not vague. Wow. Where Vietnam, really? I mean, it's more like I think a lot of people really didn't think we needed to be over there. And the people that did, they were just, I don't know that they truly understood that idea is not really attainable. This whole idea of like, we must fight the communists before they show up here. It's just like, but what is a communist? Exactly. And then people would hear about it and they're just, unless you scare people and have to lie and trump up all this bullshit to frighten people and, you know, make them afraid of an enemy that isn't really all that scary compared to, say, Hitler. I just think that if you don't come in with that message, then the morale is going to suck and you're never going to have what it takes to finish the job.
Exactly. I mean, the North Vietnamese were not going to paddle over in canoes and attack our Pearl Harbor. But a lot of armament companies absolutely needed to be in the black that year instead of the red.
Oh, yeah.
So you can't say we didn't have a great, great reason for being there.
That's true.
But like now, you've got all of these servicemen wondering, what the fuck is any of this even about at this point? Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
And not getting any kind of real answer except for communism. And that's another funny part, by the way, to me, about the rubber plantation dinner table scene, is that it generates into the same stupid argument that we're having today. Communism, socialism, communism, socialism.
Yeah.
And it's in French and you still know what the hell they're saying to each other. I mean, it's really kind of, it'd be funny if it weren't sort of sick.
I love that Francis Ford Coppola depicted that dinner scene, that dinner table scene, as Willard having dinner with a family of ghosts. because that's essentially what they were. They did, they weren't really French anymore, and they weren't Vietnamese, but they didn't really have a home either for very long. And so they were really in their own sort of purgatory, just hanging on for whatever it was worth. And so I do feel that thematically, I feel like that scene was very necessary to understand a little more about what's going on in this jungle. There's so much more at stake here.
Well, you know, it's funny. I'm glad you used the word ghosts specifically. Because another thing that I noticed when I hit the 2-hour and 37-minute mark, right before we meet Kurtz, the line that Willard says before then, when he's describing the smell of death that's in that idol, or that's in the temple.
Yes.
He says, "This was the end of the river, all right." Hmm. And it finally hits me, and it should have hit me at the beginning of this movie instead of now. The river is the River Styx. And that is why, to some degree, the entire way has seemed like a series of vignettes in the same way that Dante's Inferno does. We are traveling through levels and layers of hell. We're meandering through them. So now we got Conrad, Homer, and Dante to a certain degree. And all of these individuals in all of these places, even Kilgore to a certain degree, these people out here in the mist and the colored smoke and the fire, they're all dead already.
Right.
None of them know it yet, but they're all ghosts. They're all spirits. Even the bunnies, if you listen to the things that they're saying, while they're being felt up and so forth, these are all lost souls trapped in different morbid and vaguely personalized versions of Hades. So all dead. All of them are washed out. All of them. Again, even Kilgore, he might be a demon instead of a sinner in this hell, but he's still here. But the funny thing, by the way, also that we, before we move on from that, was that one thing we didn't touch on with Kilgore, the most famous line, which you paraphrased at the beginning of, you know, and everyone quotes that, but no one quotes what he says immediately after, which for me is really the heart of him and his character and what he was just talking about, which is after saying smells like victory, he takes a few moments and there's this look of wistful melancholy on his face. And he says, "Someday this war is going to end."
Mm.
And then what's he going to do? Go home?
Yeah.
Prune his garden? This is who he is. This is, you know, in the same way that Frank Castle was born in Vietnam, so too was this man. There is no outside of this for him. Wherever he goes, he'll take it with him and he'll wish that he was back. You know, so again, he might be the punisher rather than the punished in this scenario, but you're still in hell.
It's fascinating too to think of that. He almost seems like one of those guys that once the war is over, he's going to lose all sense of himself and think of he's almost like the star quarterback from high school.
Yes, I was just going to say that.
Like,
the guy who still wears his Letterman jacket and still talks about the big game where he scored the winning goal.
But he's got nothing else. He's Uncle Rico, man. I mean,
yeah, exactly.
Napoleon Dynamite. It is. And so you think, yeah, he almost kind of, for his sake, maybe he does die over there, but I don't think he'd be capable of it because he's just too good at what he does. So he probably won't die over there. He's like going to be he's the one non-ghost in some ways, except for after he gets back home. I think that's the story, you know.
Yeah, like, ghost down.
Unless he becomes a lifer and, you know, joins the brass. I mean, you know, become the man that, you know, Kurtz was supposed to be.
That won't make him happy either. He needs to clearly be in the shit and starting the shit.
Yeah. He likes dropping the bombs on the villages.
And it's worth mentioning, by the way, because we did touch on John Milius earlier,
mm-hmm.
that Milius was the, first of all, I mean, again, the things that he wrote were just so raw and manly. It's like being smacked in the face with a side of raw beef. And I love it. Like Conan the Barbarian. That's filmmaking. And that was him. Yeah. That was him writing. And so like Milius was the inspiration for the character of Walter Sobchak in The Big Lebowski.
I did not know that.
So basically you can picture Kilgore coming back and in the 90s starting every sentence with "I did not have buddies dying face down in the muck." He's going to start every conversation with that for the rest of his life, in the same way that some people will introduce themselves by telling people that they're Christians. It's like that's their gimmick, and they're going to start with that and go from
there. You completely blew my mind with that, because I remember I'm a huge Big Lebowski fan, and so I know that they had based Walter off of a person that they knew, but I did not realize it was John Milius.
The writer of Apocalypse Now. You can see it. You can totally see it. And Milius became such a gruff, larger than life Walter figure in real life that, you know, he, not a lot of people wanted to work with him after that.
There were so many instances in watching The Hearts of Darkness, and, you know, Francis Ford Coppola's wife did such a good job of including so much behind the scenes footage of just Francis in candid mode. And in his most vulnerable moments, there was a thread running through that whole documentary about how he had no idea what he was doing. He reached a point where he was like convinced he was making a horrible movie and he was wishing for death.
And again, it comes across. You see it, you feel it, you smell it.
Absolutely. And he had a breakdown over there, and it was very, it's to look at it in retrospect now to know how good this movie ended up being. But when you're in the shit like he was, mm-hmm. you just can't see it anymore. And he's stuck in this very organic space. He's both trapped by his process and being helped by it at the same time, but he just doesn't understand it. He's just too in it. And I think part of that, so going back to when Lucas wanted to make this film, his whole idea was to take a couple million dollars. They were going to go over to some rice paddies over in Sweden or Norway and do some extra, you know, filming on location in South Vietnam. And then they were going to come back and finish it in California. And it was just going to be, you know, the standard thing. But Coppola, he was like, no, I'm getting a whole crew together. We're going over to the Philippines, which is a great location, replacement location for Vietnam, because it has a very much the same biome, you know. The problem being, of course, that at the time, Philippines were having their own civil war. This is one of my favorite trivia things from this film. It blows my fucking mind. They go over there while they're having a civil war, and Coppola meets up with Ferdinand Marcos, who's the president at the time. And Ferdinand says, sure, I'll let you use some extras from my army and you can borrow my helicopters. It'll be great. Well, they fucking get over there, right? And they're fighting this goddamn war and they're doing these scenes and they're shooting these shots. And they're in the helicopters and the big, like, Flight of the Valkyrie scene that we mentioned before. Was it that scene? It was when all these helicopters in the air, and then like half of them have to fucking fly off because they got to go fight the war. There were rebels over in the jungle about 10 clicks away that they got reports on. And so you can see Francis sitting there, who, by the way, had to personally finance this movie because no studio was going to give him money. Luckily, he was coming off the wave from Godfathers 1 and 2. And so he was wealthy, but he also had to get money from, I think it was United Artists, kicked him a few million in exchange for, say, like, you wouldn't have to pay it back if the movie grosses over $40 million. You can keep that money. Uh-huh. Thank God it did. But so he was in hock. He had his house was mortgaged. He had his whole everything tied up in this. And he is down there in the middle of the fucking Philippines, in the middle of this hot, sweltering jungle. And people are losing it one way or the other. They're fighting the weather. They're fighting, you know, the environment. They're fighting everything. And then we watch your fucking helicopters fly off because they got to go fight an actual war that is going on while you were making your movie. And in addition to that, because there was a war going on and because we were fighting a war movie and we needed some corpses on the set because people get killed in a war, guess where some of those corpses came from? The actual war. Real corpses.
Way to save money. And the thing is that, yeah, I mean, I would call this, especially having rewatched it, for me, the best thing Coppola ever made. It's not the thing that I've watched the most, because that's not an easy thing to do. Like, obviously, Godfather 1 and 2 are more watchable.
For sure.
But, and a lot of the stuff that he did later, and, you know, Dracula, obviously, and you know, I watch that one or two times a week, Dracula.
Right.
But this is, he never made a movie like this before or since, and that's the reason, for better or worse, is that this is everything, again, every scene, every shot is telling you this is not being made by a man who feels safe. And this is not being made by a man who feels sane. This is being made by somebody who has come unmoored in a lot of ways. To me, what makes this better than really any other war movie, again, the surreality of it cannot be overstated. You've got these strange characters drifting in and out, the bizarre, unsettling alien visuals of the thing. This feels like a gunshot wound to the head away from being a David Lynch version of a war movie.
Just absolutely. Like, absolutely.
Mean, it's, again, it's not about Vietnam, really, when you come right down to it. It's just about the nature of all of this in a more, you know, gut level. And yeah, so this is not being presented by a man who is in control of himself or his mind. And that is the beauty of it and the terror of it. And I think, you know, again, obviously, this is a phrase that's bandied around a lot, but this was his personal Vietnam. And mm-hmm. fear, panic, shredded nerves, extreme and immediate danger coming in every direction, weather, war.
Oh.
The movie almost killed him or sent him to the nut house. And which brings us to something I definitely want to touch on, which is Coppola's own cameo.
Oh. As a
wartime journalist. And it's very meta, and not just because it's the usual, like, oh, the director's popping up in his own film. Isn't that cute? It's the way that he's, again, he's playing this journalist with the camera, and he's yelling at Willard, ignore the camera. Pretend we're not here. Just keep going. And first of all, that's a clear commentary on the fact that this was the first war that was ever on television.
That's true.
Cultural implications of that, trying to not just film a news segment or a documentary, but trying to, quote, like, create naturalism by manipulating it. And it's not just that, but it's Coppola's, again, not feeling great about himself right now to begin with while he's making that movie. He is condemning himself, I think, by being the man behind the camera shooting this horror.
Yeah.
And giving us this bloody, gritty, brutal war, make it cinematic as he envisioned it, and he achieves all of it in about 3 seconds.
I love the kind of dazed and confused look on Willard's face while he's kind of going, what the
right,
like as he's saying about, keep going, pretend we're not here, and he's like, okay, you know, it is just,
he's used to fellow soldiers, he is used to enemy combatants. What the fuck is this thing?
I want to also touch back on the USO scene with the Playboy bunnies. We got to talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is another one that, again, was cut from the theatrical release, but I found it to be one of the best scenes in the movie.
The cut scenes are some of my favorites.
And you're right. I don't know offhand how many other scenes were added for this. So I feel like those were the big, like that and the rubber plantation were the two big showcase. And there were probably some other little scenes spliced in there that I would have to go through. And I don't know all of them.
The Black Power Platoon and the Hopeless Great Platoon. I think those two.
This is one of the first big stops after they get on the real river, after the Kilgore scene, and they are able, the Flight of the Valkyries, and there's a big battle there. And by the way, I am amazed all over again at the how nobody was killed while that stuff was being filmed, because it looked terrifyingly authentic. And also, by the way, the cinematography in this movie, there's nothing like it. It is, to this day, it looks absolutely stunning. I think they filmed it in Technicolor, if I'm not mistaken. But it was so bright. It's so vivid. It's gorgeous. It is, the colors, the way they pop on the screen are astounding.
Awesome and terrifying. And there's great cinematography. And then there's this, which just, again, just like the doors at the beginning, it reaches out and it takes you by the fucking throat. And it shakes you. And it doesn't want you to be comfortable watching this film.
This gave me so much anxiety, because when they pull into this, it's basically they're in like, there's like a cargo exchange, kind of like you can buy some fuel, get some supplies for your boats and all that. But then there's like the way that this is lit. There's these big lights there in the dark.
Overlit in the middle of the jungle in the night, like glaringly, blindingly lit with the loud, deafening rock and roll music, hustle, 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 sex and showbiz. And again, in the middle of what may as well be Mars, like in terms of being so fucking remote from all of this. But again, we get these warped little blossoms of Americana in the middle of this ghastly jungle.
And it's cliche on top of cliche. We have one of the Playboy bunnies just dressed as a cowgirl with her little six shooters and whatnot. And then another one, she's dressed as a Native American like princess girl, you know.
Yeah, you know.
But then the scariest thing about that scene is the men in the audience.
Oh, yeah.
They are fully unrestrained. They are like starving dogs with being presented with raw steak, but held back from it. And the primal, again, to use that word, the urges that have no basis of like higher thought. It's all lizard brain happening in this crowd, and you fear for their safety of these women. It is the whole time I'm watching this scene, I'm like, get out of there, get out of there. Oh my God. And you could see the guy, the MC who introduced them, he also looks terrified.
Yeah, again, that hype man, I was gonna say, is right there in Hades with the rest of us, because that look in his eyes when they start to storm the stage of like, you know, he's used to grabbing a microphone and introducing them at the Playboy Club in Chicago, probably. Right. What right. the fuck is this?
Yeah, and this is not a Bob Hope USO moment here.
There's no bouncers. He probably figured these were the bouncers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, yeah. So that's, I mean, I keep saying,
you know, this movie feels apocalyptic, hence the name in a lot of ways, because it's like that scene kind of reminds me of something out of like a post-apocalyptic kind of a zombie thing or a road warrior or, you know, something like that, where, you know, you expect just a total wasteland beyond this place. And it felt so real, though. It felt so real and surreal at the same time.
Yeah, because Kurtz, I mean, and he represents so many things in this movie, but the one thing that he and this whole journey represent also is, again, the idea that we think of the military as any sort of rigid chain of command, disciplined. Mm-hmm. No.
Yeah.
This is people in uniforms doing whatever the fuck comes naturally to them. There is no order, there is no discipline. By the way, that guy in the Gray Village, when they're like, what happened to the commanding officer? Oh, he stepped on a landmine. Probably not. Back then, in outposts like those, where they started to realize that the war was winding down and that they weren't really there for any particular reason, a phenomenon popped up called fragging the senior officers, and to make sure that there's really just no oversight whatsoever, they just toss a grenade in some senior officer's bed in one night, and sorry, he tripped on a landmine if anyone comes to investigate. And then there's just fucking chaos and heroin running and whatever the hell they feel like doing. So I'd be willing to bet that that was probably what happened there.
Oh my God, I did not know that. That was a
big thing back then. But
that's harrowing.
Another weird thing about the USO thing, going back to that, is that then we swing back around later on, that these girls have gotten stranded in their Playboy Bunny helicopter, which is also kind of weird.
Right.
So our guys that we've been following this entire time get to get down with them, which is extremely improbable that any of these filthy grunts in their lives would ever find themselves in the situation of getting down with a Playboy Bunny. And yet here we are. We've got the one who's been obsessed with Playboy his entire life.
Oh, the cook.
He thinks he's got this Playboy Bunny in front of him that he's been idolizing for forever, and he's like putting a wig on her and like trying to dress her like she was in the centerfold. And meanwhile, the entire time she's jabbering about birds and about how she loves birds, and she has this bird act and all of these. But I just love birds. And when they start fucking, she starts fuck me like a bird, cock it to me, and like, and then again, you're watching this like what acid head.
Yeah.
Together that I'm watching. And then the other one is just, again, while she's being not just felt up, but face painted by Lance, who's out of his mind by that.
Yeah.
We watched Lance throughout the entire movie. Lance and Chef go through, like, Willard's already fucked up, but these guys at the beginning were just a little fucked up. And by the time we're done with them, they are unhinged and springs are popping out of their ears, basically. And so he's like finger painting on her face, and she's talking listlessly about how no one ever really wants to know her or listen to her, but she's still letting him feel her up because that's business as usual for her. Why the hell not? And again, it's like, these vignettes are bonkers.
So I found another trivia bit last night about the bird girl.
Yeah, what about her?
She actually did train birds at Busch Gardens. Like, that was her literal job. Like, that
she ever actually told a dude, cock it to me while he's trying to...
I wonder if... Yeah, I was like, oh, so I wonder if when she was probably asking Coppola for some motivation... You know, what are, for some notes on this character, and he did what he did with pretty much every actor on that set that he directed, was, you know, you have to find your way into this character, and I'm just giving you the notes, and he left them to kind of, that's just his style. Some directors will tell you exactly what to do and say and be, and then there are guys like Francis that are like, let's feel our way into this, man. Where's it taken us? I mean, it's a completely different thing. And that is, by the way, how this movie ended up with 10 million feet of film at the end. That's how much film was shot. And for perspective, an average 2-hour movie was about 11,000 feet of film. So that's how many movies Francis Ford Coppola shot. 10 films worth of film down in the Philippines when he made this.
I have to tell you, I would watch it.
Oh,
I would watch it.
Absolutely. And I, 10
days, but I would do it. You know?
I mean, why the hell not? And I think that contributed a lot to the vignette feel, because how the fuck do you edit something like this? Cause even he said, like, I don't even, you know, have a firm story. I'm just kind of like filming these moments. I'm filming this, you know, cause he told, why do I keep forgetting the screenwriter's name? Can you remind me again?
John Milius.
I think he told him whenever he met with him after he decided he wanted to make this movie, was like, put every single scene you ever want in this movie into the script. And I think they ended up with 1,000 pages of script.
That sounds like something Milius would say, definitely. And yeah, you know, again, I would have to pause at certain points, but I would definitely watch the whole thing. But, you know, now that you bring it up, I think another part of the whole vignettes thing is that, again, it's presented to a certain degree the way the war was presented. You have a vague goal that you should kind of meander your way to if you can, and kill your way to if you can, and it'll kind of be with you the whole time. And that's, of course, Kurtz. Like, it'll haunt you and it'll kind of always be on your shoulders, but you're never going to actually find yourself that close to it for a very long time, if ever. But in the meantime, slogging through this thing and through that mission and this adventure and this misadventure and kind of like going in every direction but the direction you feel like you should be going, until none of it makes sense at all anymore. And it's just a bunch of things that happen to you, because there's no through line in war. There's none. I mean, in any real war that you can mention,
no.
Even World War II, you can say that our goals were a little bit more clear, but even then, it's not a movie. It's not go and get the bad guy. It's not a, that's what, again, sets this apart from the movies of the 80s.
And even if they give you a mission, even in like World War II movies, like you kind of get that, like Saving Private Ryan, I think is a great example. And of course, when you think about it, like Coppola, Spielberg, Lucas, and Scorsese, those are the big guys of the 70s and, you know, 80s cinema, new Hollywood cinema, you know, and you get that sensibility again of telling these war stories, where Saving Private Ryan, again, we're talking about a World War II story. They're fighting Nazis, but you got this band of guys that got to go get this other guy. And in the midst of that, they run into this vignette of fucking nightmares, like one after the other after the other. It's told not in the same kind of like trancy acid trip way that Apocalypse Now seems to happen. And it doesn't have quite that same suspended sense of dread, like thick fucking dread and fear and terror that Apocalypse Now uses.
Whereas, and obscurity. You know,
yes.
And obscurity. Yes. Because visually, again, we have all of these colored smokes and flares and flames and regular smoke and mist.
I loved that, by the way, like the pink smoke that would just fucking come out of nowhere. Like, where did that come from? Again,
like you're on the wrong side of Alice in Wonderland. And by the way, going back to Fishburne for a second, because Fishburne getting croaked hard while the tape of his mother's voice is playing, talking about when he's going to come home.
Broke my heart.
Like, that scene is wielded as a blunt instrument, I mean, in compared to the rest of the film. Mm-hmm. But damn, is it effective, though.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, then Albert Hall gets the spear through him, which is an interesting death.
That whole thing. So when I was watching this, I had missed, and actually both times that I've watched this movie, the first time I watched this movie, as an aside, was also the first time I had ever had a particularly infamous beverage called Four Loko.
Oh my.
This was back when Four Loko was the OG. So it had all the wild stuff in it. And so I had no idea what it was. They were at the gas station. I was looking for a couple quick drinks because a friend was coming over with this movie and I'd never seen it before. This was about 15 years ago. And, you know, so I'm like, I'm going to pop one of these Four Lokos and pour it in a glass and just sit and watch Apocalypse Now. And I'm getting in this thing and I start gulping the drink because I, you know, I'm a practice drinker. I start gulping this thing down. And then probably about like 25, 30 minutes in, I am the most drunk I've been in my life up to that point. I was just tripping my ass off watching.
Honestly, why did you just like dissolve a crack rock in some cheap vodka on that? Yeah. Holy shit.
So my first viewing of that, the film with that, is just, they're inextricably linked to me now. And so I missed a lot of the finer details. So watching this again for this show almost felt like watching it for the first time. But I had missed both times, and when I was watching it the other night, that spear moment. And when Willard was actually suffocating him, I didn't realize it was because he was trying to pull Willard onto the spear sticking out of his fucking chest. He was trying to kill Willard too. I read about that as I was reading synopses and stuff of the film to make sure I didn't miss anything. And I was like, whoa, hold on a minute. He was trying to kill Willard while he was fucking dying with a spear in his chest. It was brutal. I thought he was mercy killing him. I thought that was what was happening. I didn't fucking realize that he was trying not to be impaled on that same spear.
You're not the only one. I had not actually initially realized that either. Then Lance carries Albert Hall's body out into the water, kind of like baptizing him. Lance is gone by then. And Albert Hall was interesting to see in this role, since for the rest of his life, but first of all, it's good to know he was never young. And yeah. For the rest of his life, he played this stoic black man character.
Yeah.
Basically, yeah. Played in this, you know.
You know, I gotta say, it is though interesting and good to see. I liked, you know, you always have to be a little cautious coming into a movie that was made in the, you know, in that time period with black actors in it, and hoping that their characters are being treated a certain way. You're just bracing yourself. You're bracing yourself for the, what was the Bond movie with, that was the blaxploitation one. Like, you're just kind of the one that was it.
Oh, yeah. With Yafikato was in it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Was, it was like, is it going to be something like that? No. I'm like, is it going to be like that? Or is it going to be, I don't know. You just don't know what to expect. But this film treats those two particular characters with a lot of grace and dignity and humanity. I think probably out of most of them in there. I mean, at least with Albert Hall's character as the captain of that boat, they're almost audience surrogate. And so you understand that, you know, why he's reticent and resentful. He doesn't know why he's in this mission. There's a little bit that opens up when Willard finally tells him what they're doing. But by that point, it's too late. What are you going to do? What's the fucking point? Now you know the mission, but you're still stuck there.
Those could have been far less sensitive portrayals for the time period. And not only that, but it's important, I think, to note that we are following it's mostly Willard, really, in terms of the main character, but five really main characters, two of which are black. I mean, at the time, that would have been a little bit unheard of in terms of marketing this film, it seems to me. And then they go to, and I keep calling it the Black Power outpost, because I'm not right. Really, because they had the Black Power sign, and because all the soldiers there were black. Mm-hmm. And again, you get the sense that all of these particular soldiers, again, came from the ghettos of America.
Mm-hmm. It gave a look to that experience when, quite frankly, it didn't have to. You know, I mean, I'm glad it did, but I think there's a less thoughtful director might not have done that.
Yeah, it felt authentic, but it didn't feel over the top. And, you know, we saw just again the shock and the fright and just the horror in the faces of these soldiers who are at the same time really trying to sound and act tough. Mm-hmm. But the question that gets asked almost every place that they stop, and gets asked twice at this outpost by Willard, is who's in command here? And no one can seem to give him an answer anywhere he goes, except for when it was Kilgore at the very beginning, because of course Kilgore is in command here. But he's the only kind of man who could be in command, even if he doesn't have the rank for it in that hellhole, just by virtue of his force of personality.
Right.
And so Willard keeps asking people this question, and keeps getting, he stepped on a landmine, or this or that. And then at the Black Power outpost, when he asks, they turn around and say, isn't it you? No. Aren't you the one in command? Because they don't fucking know. I mean,
right.
Yeah. So again, it's just a complete breakdown in structure. Yeah,
it's just so much anarchy. When you talk
anarchy about, like, is the word. Yes, exactly.
Humans don't have any it shows what humans actually need in order to function in even a pseudo civilized way.
What are the flaws with guns? Basically?
Or what little separates us from, say, who we are in our daily lives, you know, paying our bills and whatever, just sitting here being people that aren't going out and murdering other people, allegedly, versus tribal warfare in the, you know, no rules and you're killing to get what you want and, you know, brutalizing whomever you want and, you know, probably raping whomever you want and, you know, all these horrific things that we like to think we've evolved past as a species. But I don't know that we really have. There's such a thin veneer that we carry around.
Yeah, I mean, anytime a character in this, and by the way, that's also exactly part of Kurtz's monologue, mm-hmm. at the end as well, is to point that out, that you can paint it with whatever brush you want, but we're fucking animals. Yeah. Like, you know, it's good to have morality, and it's good to push that morality aside and just unleash the beast sometimes is his point of view. And yeah, again, just the anytime one of our guys in this movie grabs the machine gun and just starts screeching and screaming and cursing and firing it, you know, at the tribesmen who were just sort of shooting, not even arrows, but sticks at them.
Sticks, yeah, yeah.
You know, that is clearly not coming just from the situation at hand. Yeah. Every time it's coming from something deep and horrible that is finally just being unleashed because fuck it. And by the way, speaking of that scene, and again, the just absurdity that punctuates this entire movie is that while we're doing this, because that's where Albert Hall gets also the spear through him, mm-hmm. and we have this horrible, sad death scene, and Lance has the you know, makeup on his face, and he's crying, and he's just, you know, in shock.
He's got he put made a hat, like a headband out of one of his spears.
He has two of these stick arrows, one here and one here, mm-hmm. that have hit him, so that he looks like, and this would have been a thing at that time, Steve Martin's act.
Yes.
Arrow through the head. Yes. Like, well, during one of those serious and horrible parts of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's, again, what kind of madman?
Yeah.
That's that, but it's perfect.
And I can just see Coppola, like, suggesting that, almost just, like, off the cuff, almost. Like, hey, I got an idea. Let's get this. Right? Like, not something that was discussed in a meeting and that they had the costume designers do. And it did, like, it was this whole process. It really feels like one of those things, like, hey, man, wouldn't it be kind of weird if we just, like, made it like the Steve Martin bit?
Yeah, like, my father was in World War II, and he didn't talk about it often, but when he did, you know, one of the things that he would mention is that you would be in the middle of something that is out of the worst nightmare you could possibly conceive of, and blood and horror, and you're going to be traumatized by it for the rest of your life. And then there will be one detail that you will catch that's so comedically strange for what's actually going on.
Yeah.
That it just punctuates it and makes the senselessness of all of it. Again, this is not a melodrama. This is not a morality play. This is a thing where things happen to you and you have to deal with it. And that's all.
I wish I could understand when we're watching things. It just feels almost like an instinct. A movie that does feel melodramatic and feel like a morality play versus a movie like this or a movie that isn't. And I don't think I've ever really been able to put my finger on what it is that separates those things and what takes it over that edge. And as a writer myself, I wonder, sometimes I find myself straying into what feels like melodrama when that's not what I want, but I don't know why that is, you know, or why my agent will tell me this feels a little melodramatic. And I'm like, yeah, I guess it does, but I don't fucking know why. And I don't know what to do about it. I didn't get my MFA. I'm sorry.
So. Well, I think, and this is again, one writer to another, but very different kinds of writing.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's because we think on some level that we want melodrama.
Mm-hmm.
We think that we want that simplification of everything to be presented to us in a way that's almost baby food in terms of good and evil and right and wrong and all of that. And so even as writers, to a certain degree, I think sometimes we think that that's what's best, and we think that that's what's going to make us happy as creators. In my case, it's usually the reverse, though.
Right.
In my case, it's generally that the audience wants melodrama very, very bad, or thinks that they do.
Yeah.
But in those times when I've been able to convince clients, listen, an audience doesn't really, really know what they want until you show it to them.
Yes.
They only think that they know, but when you show them something they haven't seen before, it's a shiny new rattle as opposed to the old comfortable safe one, they're going to reach for it. I mean, and they're going to probably like it. And the reviews have borne me out on that, where I've broken the rules and the people love it, but it's a risk also. And you know, for example, instinctually, that there are people in the audience who will love you for giving them a feel-good ending. They might not love you for not giving them a feel-good ending, but they might respect you a lot more and enjoy themselves a lot.
That's a very good point. That's a very good point. And then
that's just a theory. Yeah.
It's so hard. And I firmly do believe that this movie couldn't be made today. It sure as fuck couldn't be remade. And I that's the thing that kept occurring to me over and over, actually, as I was watching this. And I was watching, like, say, the Kilgore scene, or the first, you know, village bombing scenes, and the combat elements of this, just watching the whole scale, but then also watching the slower, more trancey, dreamy moments and everything interwoven throughout all that. And then, of course, all the really primal shit that happens in the last, you know, half hour or so. And it's like, there's nothing about this movie that feels safe enough for anybody that would invest in it. It didn't feel safe enough back then. And that's why Coppola had to invest all of his own money in it. And he believed in it, even whenever he didn't. He believed in it, and well, he was stuck in it, so he had, the only way out was through, essentially. So he had to finish it because it was his life tied up in it. Mm-hmm. But the whole thing being, though, that nobody was ready to buy this thing until they saw it. And that's the thing that I wish, when people who are in the business of acquiring, you know, works of you know, books, comic books, movies, anything, to be like, no, it doesn't play like anything else. And if you try to describe what Apocalypse Now is, we've been talking about this movie in detail for the last hour and a half, Josh, and I firmly don't believe we spoiled shit, and we won't, because there's no way you can spoil this movie. No, it's like, nobody's going to remember those details until when you sit and watch it, you're not going to be able to anticipate any of it.
Because also, and this is one of those things that's almost, I mean, speaking of Orson Welles, probably as many people could tell you the final scene of this movie as they can with the Citizen Kane.
Rosebud and the horror.
A harm. You know, they can quote it.
Mm-hmm.
But again, does that mean that they understand the movie? Not even fucking close. As you said, we've been rattling on for 90 minutes, and we, you know, you could rattle on for 9 hours and you still wouldn't really capture what makes this movie this movie. And no, you could absolutely not make or remake this film now, because it would feel safe, and it would feel packaged, and it would have people in it that, you know, we're so familiar with from other works that we feel pretty safe with them.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just, and it wouldn't get the point across, I think, because again, you need someone who's a madman at the desperate end of his fucking rope, with a literal gun to his head, to make this movie. Nothing else would do. And again, you know, we can talk about Oliver Stone as a filmmaker, and he's a great one, or was.
Period,
I think. I wouldn't call him one now. But, you know, and it's not that those movies were bad. And again, he is, in his own way, a very strung out and fucked up and desperate character. And that
definitely
came across mostly in his, like, doing lots of peyote phase,
yes,
which is my favorite phase of his career.
For but sure.
Even Oliver Stone hashing out his own demons with something like Platoon or Born on the Fourth and that kind of thing, he's still kind of doing it from a place of relative safety.
Yeah.
He's making this movie in a place and in a context where, in terms of filmmaking, there's a beginning, middle, and end.
Pre-production,
post-production.
It's linear, right? I mean, even the movies of his that feel trippy, like JFK, you know, some really interesting editing choices done in that movie.
Yeah, for sure.
But they still feel like they follow a line, you know, from point A to point B. Yeah. And, you know, because, you know, he's got his funding, he has his actors, he has his location, he's got it all set. You know, Coppola goes down there, makes that deal with the president and gets his things all going. But then right after they get all their sets built, the monsoon comes in and destroys them all. They've spent millions of dollars building like that temple, you know, that was made out of actual mud bricks that weighed hundreds of pounds and had to be hoisted by ropes by teams of mostly tribal members and army. There was a very indigenous presence on this movie set. And they were all involved. It was a huge crew. And of course, you know, he's paying all this. So when all that all gets destroyed, then they have to take a 3-month break. Oh, and what they didn't even talk about the fucking fact that Martin Sheen has a heart attack on the set, nearly dies. He has like a fucking Widowmaker at 36 years old.
Yeah.
Has a Widowmaker on the set of this fucking movie in the middle of the jungle. And he has to leave for like a month. So there's another delay. But of course, while that's going on, they're filming, they still have to keep making the movie. And it's really interesting to watch you can kind of tell when Sheen's not there, because he's the star of the movie, but his face is just not there for a while. But they use a body double and they kind of frames the shots a certain way so that, you know, he's there physically, the character's there, but he's not really in the center. But what's interesting about that is I feel like that was kind of a good thing because it gave an opportunity to show us even more of what was going on. I think it forced them in a different direction to explore other things that they might not have. I don't wish Martin Sheen had a heart attack, by the way. I wouldn't wish that on him. But it was one of those things where they managed to do, it forced them again to do something, you know, do other things and take other risks and do what they had to do to get around yet another massive obstacle. And I love the part in Hearts of Darkness where they talk about after Marty came back on set after his heart attack, after he'd recovered, and he looked great. He was full of color. He had a tan, which, you know, when you've got some blocked arteries and they're no longer blocked and your heart's working, you're going to look better typically than you have been for a while.
One way of looking at it, but another way of looking at it is that he looked better after having a fucking coronary than he looked after making part of this film.
Absolutely.
It's far worse on the human body and psyche.
Yes. That's so true.
With the Oliver Stone parallel also, I think what it comes down to a certain degree is that Oliver Stone was a completely fucking insane person. But Stone was also a tyrant.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
He was able to point his madness like a bazooka in very, very specific targeting. And this is not what we're seeing in Apocalypse Now. This is not a man who's in control of his own mind or mental issues even slightly. It's a guy who's being ripped around like a rag doll in a Rottweiler's mouth.
Yeah. By them. How would you say that compares, say, to the work ethic of Stanley Kubrick, who was also a tyrant and a madman?
You can draw a very straight line between Kubrick and Stone, and especially in terms of how they treated their actors. And Stone had a cadre of guys like John C. McGinley, who would show up in movie after movie after movie that he made, because whatever the test was, they passed it.
Right.
And, you know, and he's been interviewed about, like, you know, we hear that he's a monster and a tyrant to work for, and yet you're in every movie that he does. And McKinley is like, you know, it's boot camp. And if you take it personally, you're going to sink. And if you just keep your head down, trust in it, do what you're told, you'll thrive. And that's all. And that's the difference. So whereas it's a huge difference between, again, Coppola's method of directing his actors, which is to trust them in a lot of ways. Kubrick, it's not, we've talked about it to a certain degree, does not trust his actors. 80, 90, 100 takes until they go fucking insane. You know, Coppola didn't do that. He's not that kind of a guy. So that's sort of a difference, but it also gave him less control over this complete and total fuck story that he's presiding.
I mean, that's how you end up on set for, what, for 2 years or a year and a half? I can't remember. I think it was a year and a half, and then they spent, you know, so far over budget.
There's a saying in showbiz, never never invest your own money. Never. No. I don't care how much you want the project. I don't care how successful you think it's going to be and what return you're going to. No, never invest your own money. It is a hard, someone would have told him that, I'm sure. And he did it anyway. But you had also mentioned body doubles for Willard. And I wanted, that's actually, I had taken a note here on something that I never noticed before. There are scenes toward the end of this movie. Well, Willard is Kurtz's captive. And there's more than one shot where there appear to be multiple versions of Willard on screen using those body doubles. There was, there'd be like a Kurtz follower who's lit weirdly, like with the colors and the darkness, whose build and their clothes and their hair. When you see in the mind's eye, thinks that it's Willard. And then you see that Willard is on screen already and he's doing something else. And one example is when Kurtz is kind of ranting at Willard with this madness in the foreground, and Willard's half dead, and he's just lying there staring like, I want to kill you, motherfucker, please. And in the background, out of focus, is a figure you'd swear is Willard. You'd swear if you didn't see Willard's face in the front, like the same build, same outfit. And what's he doing? He's doing the same Tai Chi. Willard has done at least twice now in this movie, and he's just out of focus. And then later on, there's a figure in, he was dancing in the water buffalo ceremony and baptizing the water buffalo. And again, the build, the hair, all of it. Is that Willard? Has he become a convert? Has he, is he part of this ceremony? And then it cuts to the water and the real undisputable Willard.
Yeah.
In the full on war.
Oh, paint, the iconic shot. Probably, would you say the most iconic shot of this movie?
The reason for that, I think, goes back to, and it's a shame because, again, it was cut from the theatrical version, so people wouldn't get this at all. But what the French woman said to him on the plantation, there are two of you. There is the one who kills, and there is the one who loves. Her husband had told her he didn't know if that made him a monster or a god. And we understand now that Kurtz is absolutely both of those things at the same time. He is a monster and a god. The one of him who loves and the one of him who kills are the same person, but that's not true for Willard. Not really.
I am so glad that that scene was included in a version of this movie, because you're absolutely right. It gives so much more depth to the characters and the themes. And I did not notice that about the body devil stuff at all. So
you're right.
Aces on that, man. I completely missed that. We have to talk about Brando.
We
got to talk about him. Cause I mean, quick, again, flash history lesson on Marlon Brando here. Kind of a hard guy to work with. Wouldn't you say? he has a bit of a method actor thing going on, and, you know, method actors have been in more contemporary discussion recently because they're getting a little more attention. We got the guy from Succession, who Jeremy Strong. He is the lead in one of the leads in that show. It's an ensemble, but he is a method actor, and he is known to be very difficult to work with. And, you know,
Jared Leto springs to mind.
Oh, Jesus Christ. He's probably the worst of the worst offenders. Daniel Day-Lewis, probably the more civilized version of a method actor, from what I've heard. I've heard that he's a delightful man, but I don't know when he's in character. Maybe when he was playing Daniel Plainview in fucking There Will Be Blood. I don't imagine he would have been fun to hang out with.
Probably not. But the thing about Brando is that calling him a method actor, it's a little loose. Well, method actors generally don't need to have their lines taped to the chest of the person that they're doing the scene with. They would be in the moment enough to be able to act.
They know their character. And see, that's the thing. Brando fucking, he nearly walked from this movie because
he always nearly walks from
everything. Yeah, he's such a prima donna. He was such a prima donna. He's no longer with us. I mean, this is the man who he could be very insufferable. Full of antics, this guy, that we could honestly, let's just say, premature invitation. I think we should do a Brando episode just devoted to Brando.
I'll say the short thing about Brando before we, because we can easily do that. Because Kurtz, finally, again, 2 hours and 37 minutes. Mm-hmm. And even then, the first 5 minutes of Kurtz are in near total darkness, reached this mythological horrifying, because we've already, by the way, gotten past the photojournalist played by Dennis Hopper and all of the severed heads and hanging bodies and savages, which includes Kurtz's own men who are now, you know, nude and painted up and carrying tribal shit. And, you know, I mean, so again, as bad as we thought it was going to be throughout this movie, it's worse. It's much worse.
And entering that scene, the boat is coming up this part, like into a delta of some kind, right? And it's just kind of ends.
The end of the River Styx. This is the final stop in hell. And we have this terrifying bald Hulk with his eyes just gleaming from the shadows. And it's great. And I loathe Marlon fucking Brando. I hate him. I hate his process. I hate his fucking work ethic. Again, real actors don't have to read their fucking lines on stage or screen. The way he treated his actors was fucking disgusting.
Terrible.
Like, yeah. I think it was the score that was directed by Frank Oz with Brando in it, and Brando kept calling him Miss Piggy and like running him down on set.
Oh, he was an asshole. It was a...
Yeah, this movie is another perfect example of that. Brando had contracted that he was going to lose weight to play Kurtz, because in the book, Kurtz is this sweating skeleton of a creature with these like coal burning fucking eyes, and he's like being carried around on a dais and he can barely move his arms, which is compelling. And when it's time to shoot, Brando shows up and he's twice the fucking size that he was.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's just disrespect on a base. As someone who was going to be a director, that's disrespect on a basic level.
Well, yeah, you agree that a character is going to look a certain way, and that's an actor's job, by the way. And that is not we're not making statements on whatever the size of a person, whatever.
This isn't that. This is just about.
No, it's like you are contracted.
Putting a thumb in the eye of the director for no reason but to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And but at the same time, when it comes to the guy's performances, and again, even knowing that he's reading his lines, even knowing that he's being a prick, even knowing all of that, you look at him and you can't deny the screen results. Corleone, Kurtz, his Dr. Moreau is bizarrely my favorite one.
Yeah.
He made all of these cinematic characters that are some of my favorites. So just like with Coppola filming Sheen's Breakdown and the rest of it, we may hate the way this shit gets made, but...
I am such an old school, my favorite Brando is On the Waterfront, probably still, and Corleone, sure. But the presence that he has in that moment, even though, like, watching Hearts of Darkness and seeing him show up, not knowing his shit, he doesn't know these lines, he doesn't know the character, he had never read Heart of Darkness, he didn't even read the fucking book, Josh.
He doesn't care.
Heart of Darkness is like a fucking pamphlet, okay? You could read it in 20 goddamn minutes. He didn't even do that. He could have read it on the plane on the way over. So Coppola is freaking out a little bit because, you know, already they had to change the filming schedule just to accommodate him, because they had to film the end first in order to accommodate Brando, because he didn't want to be there for more than a certain amount of time. And
on the one hand, who can blame him, but still.
Right. Nobody did. You know, that was the hardest part of casting this, was they couldn't get all the people they originally wanted because none of them wanted to fucking go there. And they weren't making a lot of money. You know, they weren't being enticed with big dollars here. It was more like they were more enticed by what they knew of Coppola's brand, essentially, before they signed on. If he hadn't done Godfather first, then we wouldn't be, you know, this wouldn't happen at all, I don't think. But he shows up, doesn't know his shit. And then I love the moments in the documentary when Coppola is trying to decide how to end this movie. He doesn't know how to end this thing. It was haunting him through the entire process, is how do I end this thing? I still don't really know. They start to film this and Brando doesn't know his shit. And he doesn't want to halt production for 3 weeks, and he can't, in order to write more. So Brando they start letting him improvise. And did see the moments where he's just coming up with these different lines?
Yeah.
Almost seemingly off the top of his, he's just in the mode of Kurtz. And he's just saying this shit that is just unbelievable. Like, what is he fucking talking about? But it's so good.
That's also Kurtz. Yeah,
it's absolutely. So good. I mean, they just showed this whole long reel of him, take after take of him improving and ad-libbing this stuff. And it was amazing. So yes, is difficult and awful. And honestly, he was also a very unsanitary man, apparently, too. So as loathsome of a person as he could be, Jesus, I couldn't imagine anybody else in this role. Not a chance. Not a fucking chance. And
big enough.
And the way Sheen played against him, too. I love the scene, the moment, so much. I think it was when Brando asked him, like, do you have a problem with my process? Or was it? And then he said, I don't think you have one. I don't see one. Yeah. Yeah. Was just so great. But I want to ask you how you ultimately felt about the ending of the movie, starting with Willard moving on Kurtz at the end.
I can see how the ending would have been a problem for Coppola, although first of all, try not to film a movie until you have the ending in mind. That's my yes. They didn't make that a formal lesson at Columbia College, but they didn't really on the other hand, Casablanca, which didn't have one either.
Oh, it didn't. Okay. I didn't know that.
I can see how, yeah, they were writing that movie as they went along. And that's what they were shooting. I can see how it would be difficult to end this movie because the book does not end this way. In the book, because Kurtz is so sick, he has, we assume, malaria and several other things as well. He is convinced to come back. I don't think the name was Willard in the book. I think it was Marlowe who had been.
It was Marlowe, yeah.
Because he was a character from a bunch of other Joseph Conrad books. Convinces him, improbably, to come back along the river with them, but in the process, Kurtz doesn't make it, which is not as interesting. And you can't
really. Anticlimactic. Yeah.
And also, it's Kurtz. Like this version of Kurtz, at the very least, he ain't going anywhere.
No.
Far more than this other Kurtz was in the book. He has to die.
With extreme prejudice.
Yeah. He really, there's only one way to end this. It's either him or it's Willard. And if it's Willard, that doesn't make a lot of sense. And the funny thing to me was that when Willard had sort of made up his mind to kill Kurtz, and again, you have an inner monologue, which is kind of indispensable.
He admires Kurtz. Like really, this whole trip up the river, he's reading this man's file and he's just coming enamored with him almost. Like,
he's filled with awe.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
And he's also obviously, it's the specter of himself. Mm-hmm. This man started off as Willard did in special forces, killing whoever the fuck he was sent to kill and never really questioning. And he, don't worry, kid, because if you keep this up, you're going to go to the top and realize, fuck your top. I've got my own. And also, I think on some level, given the letter that Kurtz, we know, sent to his family, it's not outside the realm of, it's never stated, but I think it's not outside the realm of possibility when the photojournalist says, he's sick, man. He's gonna die soon, man.
Hopper's delivery there was so good.
Were they gonna say about him that he was a kind man, that he was a wise man? Who's gonna tell people? Me? Not. Kind of a thing, you know. So but like, you know, but the fact that he specifically feels the need to say he's sick and he doesn't think he's going to be alive much longer leads me to wonder, what made Kurtz suddenly take a left fucking turn from this? It could have been ideology. I think we are meant to believe that the man snapped, but a brain tumor could very easily explain all of this.
I think that's why Coppola probably didn't, well, I think he even said he didn't lose his mind when Brando shows up 50 pounds heavier than he was supposed to be, was the fact that he could use that in some way. He can build that into the character. What would make him immense, big man? Yeah. Because it's the flip side of this. It's the both sides of the same coin, and it plays to the same madness.
And that's why Kurtz, through the photojournalist, basically communicates to Willard that as Kurtz is Jesus Christ, Willard is going to be his personal John the Baptist. Because who else could?
Right.
Who else could go forth and spread the gospel of Kurtz in any way that anyone would listen to? Only him. Because only, you know, he's the only one who can begin to like be broken in such a way as to understand. And Kurtz's monologue about his methods, which is one of the most chilling monologues I've ever heard in my life, at the end, that the way to decisively win, and the whole thing about the chopped off arms, by the way.
Oh, God. John Melius had said that he knew the guy who claimed that he experienced that with the arms.
And he said he wept like a grandmother and thought to himself, if I could have a battalion of men like that, I could win this thing extremely easily. Mm-hmm. And so he claims that the way to decisively win and end this fuckscape of a war is through the use of spectacular atrocity by men who are moral and, again, at the same time, willing to commit the most immoral and inhuman acts to enforce that morality. And it seems to me, to some degree, and maybe his sort of, you know, bulk adds to this, Kurtz is a metaphor for the bomb when you come right down to it. The specter of that was so much with us still from having, you know, dropped it twice at the end of World War II to end that war. And because it had seemed so mired and so hopeless at that point, that it was just like, hit the button and end this fast or it goes on fucking ever. And we don't know that we can win against people who actually fly planes into us and immolate themselves. When we don't understand that, but we, you know, if we just have this awesome blast and then maybe another one of them, they'll surrender and they'll stop. And, you know, that's atrocity.
We're having that same discussion with Russia right now, you know, in Ukraine, like, oh, if we just drop one on St. Petersburg or Moscow, this will be over, man. And it's like, who wants to do that, though?
But again, it's like, you know, commit the ultimate immoral act to win a moral war. And would we end Vietnam the same way? That was the question back then, was people saying, just do it. We did it before. Why don't you just do it now? This is lasting five times as long. And we're just, you know, feeding people into a meat grinder. You have the bomb. Use the bomb. Why not use it now? And so that was the question. Could we unleash the ultimate devastation on millions just to make this fucking thing stop? And if we did, would it even work at this point? Or would it just, you know, dig these people in even further? I think he is, again, he's a living embodiment of many things in this movie, but I think he is nuclear holocaust.
Oh yeah, nuclear holocaust, the most malignant cancer. You know, he embodies pretty much the worst or the most brutal aspects of humanity. Just, you know, and so I think that would have to fit in a massive package that Brando brought down. I like to think that even though he did show up completely unprepared and it was just completely lazy on his part, I'm sure he walked away from that thinking, yeah, I'm a genius. He probably gave himself all the credit in the world for showing up 50 pounds overweight.
So. But again, as much as I hate it, I also kind of love it a little.
I wish there were more stories like this because they blow my mind, but I don't think they would blow our mind as much if there were more stories like this. So God, I'm grateful for this movie. Like, and as an example of probably some of the most effective storytelling that you'll ever see on film about a conflict that is inscrutable to this day and will always be. And the movie in itself sometimes feels inscrutable, but the joy, I would never say there's joy in watching this movie, but what you get from it ultimately is just this sort of deep understanding. And there are a lot of people that haven't seen this movie, by the way, especially I would say millennial and old, you know, younger. So
it might not be for them.
maybe not. I just feel like more people need to see it, continue to see it. It holds up. It's eternal. It's timeless. I was looking for dated references. I was looking for cheesy moments. I was looking for those things that you just see in a 70s or 80s movie that take you out of it just the tiniest bit to kind of make you laugh at the just how things were different back then. This movie doesn't do that.
Cockatoo didn't do that for me.
That would be in a movie today.
Yeah. But like two other things that I wanted to say about Kurtz, though. Was one of his, again, great, great lines, and all of his lines were great, really. But when he uses the word judge again, when he says to Sheen, you have the right to kill me, but you do not have the right to judge me any more than, you know, an antelope judges a lion for bringing it down. It's just too, it's bigger than that. It just is. Not good, not bad. Don't talk about good and bad. Just talk about, you know, kill or not kill. That's all that it comes down to.
Mm-hmm.
And there was that, but then also about the ending was Willard, who you would think, after all of this, would have a very, very firm understanding of Kurtz as a character. One of the last things that he says about him before he takes him out is, you know, he just wanted to die standing up like a soldier. No, he wants to die crucified as Christ.
Absolutely.
He didn't fight back. because, you know, first of all, again, he was clearly a tortured man, but also because, I mean, this is, what's he going to do? Keep living and keep doing this? No, this is the ending that he wants to some degree is to.
He understands the rules of nature, right? I mean, at the end of the day, he knows what's coming. He knows what's coming for him. It feels a lot like a deep understanding of that you get out of No Country for Old Men. Like, you can't stop what's coming, which is the line that runs through that movie, like a thread, a dark thread. And this, the same thing here. I think Kurtz knew when he looks up from the thing he's recording and he looks behind him and, you know, Willard's walking in with that terrifying machete and his face all painted. It's just that moment has come. And I love how it played out with the slaughtering of the water buffalo and the way that was edited together into that moment.
You don't have that as much if Kurtz is skinny, but if you can kind of associate the hugeness, the immensity of Kurtz
with
the immensity of this big shouldered, you know, flat headed, stubborn creature. Like it parallels, you know, it's like George Lucas said, it's like poetry. It sort of rhymes.
Yeah. And you're making a sacrifice to the gods. And what I get from this too, we never know what happens to Willard at the end of this thing. But you already know there's no coming back from this. How does anyone ever come back from this? And that's a question that we can ask of the, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of soldiers that fought over there.
Not the ones who killed themselves, which I imagine Willard probably would.
Absolutely. I mean, my God.
I mean, once you've stared into the abyss that deeply and then you're sent home and told to, you know, again, be a normal guy, you're not long for this world. He's not going to go to therapy because look at him.
No.
I wouldn't be honest with a therapist if he did. My guess would be this guy probably ate a gun pretty fast, you know.
Yeah.
Because you can't picture Willard as an old man. He's just, you never made it.
No, I mean, that's as old as he's ever going to get. I'm with you completely on that. And that ultimately, you know, call it a bummer note if you want. But the thing is, though, this movie doesn't start you off with any hope. So so you don't ever, it doesn't feel like a cheat. Doesn't feel like that was anything other than you expect. In fact, if it was a happy ending, that would be the cheat.
Well, and that kind of brings me to, you know, kind of my coda on the whole thing, if I had one, would be that watching it this time, you know, Kelly Hager, who you know, because she and I have been
love
on
her.
Your show, yeah, and you've been on ours. When we met a quarter of a century ago, we were both working at a Hollywood Video, and I remember those shelves like the back of my hand. Apocalypse Now, you'd find it in drama, or you'd find it in action. This is not a drama movie, and this is not an action movie. This is a horror movie.
Absolutely.
100%. And it's a weirder one than usual. And it's structured differently. And there's maybe you could even say there's a longer than average buildup. Although me personally, I think there isn't, because we get to some pretty horrific shit fairly quickly. By the time the boat pulls in and you see all of that, I just keep coming back to the word atrocity. And especially when that moment of Kurtz tossing Chef's severed fucking head in Willard's lap. Willard just starts, he's sitting there in his own piss and shit and mud and looking like he's got five different diseases. And he just starts screaming and howling with this severed head in his lap. And we've got all this grotesquery, violence, descents into madness that are visceral and haunting, all to keep the audience tense and scared and off guard for the whole flick, with all of these, again, surreal visuals and almost supernatural, really. I mean, and like you said, this culminates with, yeah, the water buffalo killing. And can't say this enough, that was a real water buffalo.
It was, and the American Humane Society, and it's very controversial even to this day.
But oddly, I would think that wouldn't be, only for the reason that they were already, the local tribesmen were already killed.
That's the thing, and that's how it ended up in the film, was Coppola's wife, I don't have her name written down, and please forgive me for that. I will have that in the show notes.
You'll never speak to him.
Oh, I know. I'm not going to get any free wine from the Coppola Vineyard, unfortunately. So, but she was out, because she made this documentary, she was out walking the village, nearby village, and came upon them doing this, the local tribes, tribe doing this ritualistic type sacrifice, animal sacrifice of pigs. And then she saw them doing it to the water buffalo as well. And she had to pull Francis out of his, you know, writing cave. He didn't want to come outside because he's like tap, tap, tapping away on his typewriter. And mm-hmm. she finally, you know, cajoles him enough to get him out there and witness one of these ceremonies. And of course, he makes friends with the tribesman chief, and they give him the heart, which is the most valuable, part of the animal. Yeah. And so that's ultimately how that ended up in the final movie, because you understand, again, it just ties together all the elements of the environment and the rituals and, you know, everything. But yeah, it was controversial, but this is what that culture did and still does. So many tribes all over the world do this. They do it in Tibet. They do it in Bhutan. They do it everywhere. And I feel like we need to watch it knowing that it was not just done in vain. They did not just gleefully, you know, murder a water buffalo for the hell of it. That animal was going to be slaughtered and it was used properly. So
exactly. But the funny thing for me, though, is that you got this in 79, just a year later, you've got Cannibal Holocaust.
Oh, yes.
Savage jungle tribes and the same kind of gru and gore and involved butchering real live animals.
Yes, very much.
Unfortunately, not as part of an actual tribal ritual, but just because the director kind of thought it would be unsettling. And my God, I didn't eat for a week after that.
No. Same.
One thing to look at that and say that although it does make that movie grosser and scarier and more horrible, it's also kind of like, don't kill animals for the sake of it on screen. That's right. Not a good thing. That's separate from this, but it does emphasize even more what I just said. This is a horror movie.
Yes.
Absolutely a horror movie in the same way that Cannibal Holocaust is to a certain degree. I mean, it's a more polished version. It's a longer version and it has more to say. But ultimately, both are just grabbing the back of your head and shoving you face down wound and rubbing your face in it. Like, yeah. I gotta respect that. I respect shock value if it's pointed correctly and aimed.
Yeah, exactly. And I will say, you know, I've talked to people that have seen this movie that ordinarily, you know, they're not, it's not easy to get them to sit through something like this, but they enjoyed this film or respect this film and recommend this film. So even if we're talking about this and you haven't seen it and you're feeling scared away from it because of, you know, the things that we've talked about, I would say that you will find yourself surprised by how easily you fall into this narrative. I firmly believe I could show this movie to my 20-year-old kid. Well, you know, he's a movie nut, you know, but I could show this movie to, I could have shown it to him 10 years ago. He probably would have been like, whoa.
Yeah.
So, you know, just to keep that in mind, too, as you go and watch this brilliant movie that's like a showcase of the useful side of madness. I could relate on a human level. I've been lost in my own creative process in a much more micro scale, but anybody who's an artist of any kind can watch this and then learn about the making of it and go, oh my God, that's like, I could see that happening to me. And so if I made a movie, that's probably what would happen. So that's why you won't see me making movies, probably be the end of me. Wow. So
first day of film school, my friend, first day of film school, that teacher walked in. He said, raise your hand if you love problems. No one raised their hand. He said, you get your fucking hands in the air or you get out of this goddamn school. Because that's all filmmaking is every day you will have 20 problems and you better thrive on it.
Yeah.
You better be asking yourself for plan B, C, D, all the way to Z on anything that could possibly happen. And when something happens that you didn't expect, then that better, again, just give you an adrenaline edge, because if you're not that person, you ain't making movies, pal.
No, you have to be the snail living on the knife's edge. You know, you got to be that. It's one of those things that reminds me over and over again that it's a miracle that anything gets made in movies, period.
Amen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And my God, we've talked for 2 hours. I feel like we could talk for two more, but I think we did good. What do you think?
Oh, I think a 10. Worst episode ever.
I actually want to go back
this
and
is the end of your whole listenership. You're
this
never going to
tune end.
My yeah. only friend, the end of your podcast, my friend.
Well, as Josh mentioned earlier, we, and I think I might have mentioned it too, but we had a plan to actually do Bram Stoker's Dracula. In addition to this, we're going to push Bram Stoker's Dracula into its own episode, get Kelly Hager on here, because she loves her some Winona Ryder. She was not prepared to talk and didn't want to. Apocalypse Now is not her bag. So we're hoping to rope her on and do a more proper exploration of that movie, because there's some fun stuff involved in that one as well.
And I can do a lot of impressions from it too.
Oh, I cannot wait. Can you do the Keanu Reeves character?
My dear Mina, I'm writing to you from the castle of Count Dracula.
Whoa.
Carrying boxes of decrepit earth.
I think I need to go in and watch that. I was like, man, I could watch Apocalypse Now again after talking about this, but now I think I need to go watch Dracula.
So. I think Dracula's a nice little swish it around palate cleanser.
Yeah, maybe. Absolutely. Swish your mouth out with a little blood. It'll be good. But thank you so much, Josh, for coming on. Again, I want to tell people to please go over and listen to Press Play and Scream. They cover a huge range of amazing horror movies. They have some great guests. Not just me, I've been on a couple episodes, but they've had like famous people. So get on over there and check out their show. And we're going to have Josh back on here again very soon as we pick apart more movies and whatever.
Probably just kind of like as a caveat emptor to people who are going to, all the celebrities that you're talking about were just me. I was doing more impressions.
You are a really good impressionist.
I'm wow. The most famous person on the show, and no one knows who the fuck I am.
Oh my god. All right, my friends. This is the end. I might put that song in as we fade out. Maybe different cutout music than my usual fare. So
ASCAP is gonna shoot you in the head if you try to do that without the rights.
You're right. I'm not ready yet. All right, guys. I guess I should sign off and just say, check me out on Twitter at DD Darkness Time, or send me an email if you've seen this movie and you have some opinions. What's your favorite version? There's like four or five different cuts of this movie. What's your favorite? You probably, so many of you screaming at us for watching the redo instead of, you know, the final cut or the, you know, theatrical or whatever. Let us know what you think at ddarknesstime@gmail.com. I'm also up on the Patreon now if you want to join up and become a ding dong, part of the ding dong army. Go ahead and do that. And I think that's all I got. I think we're good. All right, we are signing off. Have a good one. This episode was produced by yours truly, Allison Dixon, and wouldn't be possible without the amazing contributions of countless friends, family, and Patreon supporters. Big shouts also go out to Nathaniel Dixon for all the show art, as well as Spencer Morlock and Ken Dixon for the music. I'll be back with something new next week. In the meantime, you know what to do. Be good, you little ding-dongs.